When you start to actually define sustainability, there's a couple definitions that are tossed around most frequently. One comes from the Iroquois Federation, looking 7 generations into the future. Another comes from the UN, and it's around about doing things today and looking at the impacts of tomorrow. But I would say that if we're talking about sustainability in a business context, we need to be even more specific and create a definition that really fits our industry.
Hey, it's David, and you're listening to Leadership Without Losing Your Soul, your source for practical leadership inspiration, tools, and strategies you can use to achieve transformational results without sacrificing your humanity or your mind in the process.
Hey, welcome to the show today. And I am so excited to introduce you to our guest. Today, you are going to get some very practical ways to create meaningful strategic change in areas of life that really, truly matter. So, when we talk about human-centered leadership, we are getting really down to some real meaningful change that's not always easy to do. And our guest today is going to help us get there. She is an expert in this. Maisie Gansler is her name. She's the Chief Strategy and Brand Officer at Bon Appetit Management Company, which serves restaurants, corporations, universities, and museums, and is a subsidiary of the largest food service company in the world, Compass Group. Over 3 decades, Maisie's helped grow the company to more than $1.7 billion in revenue, become the gold standard for sustainability, and get recognition from prestigious organizations like the James Beard Foundation. She is the go-to expert on how food companies can make positive change, called upon for strategic counsel by advocacy groups, startups, and big business alike. And today, she is going to talk to us about her latest book and some of these specific ways that we can create this kind of change. The name of the book is You Can't Market Manure at Lunchtime. I think that is the first manure-focused title I have featured on the show, Maisie. You Can't Market Manure at Lunchtime and Other Lessons from the Food Industry for Creating a More Sustainable Company. Maisie Gansler, welcome to Leadership Without Losing Your Soul.
It's great to be here, David. I really appreciate you having me.
Well, I am so glad we were able to do this for our listeners. The behind the scenes, I was sick last week. This week I'm traveling, and Maisie was gracious enough we were able to rearrange things to make it happen. So I'm very excited that you're able to be here. So Maisie, before we dive into sustainability and everything else, and I know that you've listened to some episodes of the show before, so you know what's coming. I have to ask you if you could take us back as far your one of your earliest memories of yourself as a leader, and where does that take you?
Well, when I heard the question in other episodes, I really thought about that word leader and when was I aware of that concept for the first time in an active way. And what came to me was in 7th grade, I was a very gold ribbon kid. And so I had already identified that I wanted to go to the Cornell School of Hotel Administration. I wanted to go into
By
hospitality.
7th grade.
By 7th grade, I
Wow.
actually had decided that a few years earlier, but I was taking arts and crafts in junior high and enjoying it. But I thought Cornell would really want me to exhibit leadership. And so I actually changed from the arts and crafts elective to the leadership elective because I thought that was going to get me closer to my goal, which was probably true in the big scheme of things, but I think in a more specific way, I don't think universities look at your 7th grade transcripts.
That is hysterical. You sound a little bit like our son. Sometimes he would do things like that in 7th grade. Wow, that's so amazing. And so you had that awareness of what you were after, what you want to do, and what to be thinking about in terms of the relationships and the credentials and credibility you need to establish. That is fascinating. But you're right. Nobody's looking at those 7th grade transcripts, are they? Oh, wow. Very goal driven. Oh, I love that. All right. So let's dive into it here. We're talking about, so your book, You Can't Market Manure at Lunchtime, focuses on creating sustainability and your experiences and interviews you've done with a number of different industry leaders in the food industry. Let's pull back and just define for everyone, because everyone today is coming from different industries all over. Everyone has leadership and human-centered leadership in common. But let's define sustainability. What do you mean when we're talking about sustainability?
It's a really great question, and one that I have been asked a lot over my career, and quite honestly, kind of passed off with a joke for many years, saying sustainability is kind of like the the Supreme Court definition of pornography, you know it when you see it. It gets a good laugh with a group, but it really undercuts the importance of the issue. When you start to actually define sustainability, there's a couple definitions that are tossed around most frequently. One comes from the Iroquois Federation, and it's about looking seven generations into the future. It's where I believe the seventh generation's brand must have gotten their name. Another comes from the UN, and it's around about doing things today and looking at the impacts of tomorrow. But I would say that if we're talking about sustainability in a business context, we need to be even more specific and create a definition that really fits our industry. So at Bon Appetit Management Company, we put together a definition of sustainability for food service specifically, and it highlights the issues like air, land, water, but it also talks about the different stakeholders, such as farmers, farm workers, even animals. I'm talking about animal welfare. And so no matter what your industry is, I think you should sit down and figure out what does sustainability mean in your part of the world. It's kind of a Mad Libs exercise. You fill in the blanks of the words of what you want to protect for the future through your business.
It's so fascinating that the seventh generation definition, the stakeholder approach that you're taking, and then the resource approach. You know, the commonality of all of it is that whatever we're doing is something that we could keep doing forever without negative impact, without it going away, without it adversely impacting people or resources or whoever, whatever, over time to the level of extinction almost sometimes it seems. But it's fascinating that on the one hand, it's so easy to think about. On the other, it's challenging to truly define in your area.
And some people would even say you need to go further with a concept of plus one, that you're not just protecting those resources, you're actually strengthening them, you're adding plus one to them. I got to be honest and say I'm not sure I ever got that far. I'm still trying to protect.
Yeah. You know, some of my earliest leadership work, I remember running into, and it wasn't even the leadership context, it was the law of the commons, you know, and I don't remember who first coined it, it goes way back, but the idea that like if there's this common field and all the villagers are grazing their sheep, if everybody grazes it intentionally and a little bit, everybody can have sheep forever if we do it in that kind of a way. But if one farmer, you know, goes and puts too many sheep on it, the field dies, nobody has any sheep, you know, that kind of thing. It's just at a simple level, like, and that's definitely food related. But I've often thought that that is part of the role of every leader in just about any capacity, is helping address all of the different ways in which that law of the commons comes to bear on our work.
Yeah, when you raise that, it harkens to me the concept that a lot of companies deal with, which is around short-term results, quarterly reporting, especially in a public company. If you're only focused on this quarter's results and what that does to your share price, you're going to graze that commons as quick as you can and try to beat out the sheep next to you to get that quarterly result. And you're going to worry about next quarter. And as you point out, when you talk about sustainability in terms of seven generations, it's sort of the opposite of that quarterly mentality. And then you want to preserve the commons for your own benefit as well as for your neighbors.
Absolutely. Well, I think that is the role of every leader. And I'm glad everyone that I glad you're listening today, if you're listening to this show, because obviously it's something you care about. So Maisie, let's dive into you can't market manure at lunchtime. So well, first, let's talk about that title, because it's fun. You can't market manure at lunchtime. And you get into, it's very readable. I encourage everyone to take a look at this, even if you don't care about the food industry specifically. Maisie, you've written this book to be so engrossing and compelling in the stories that you tell and your own work. You start talking about manure lagoons and things with pig farming and just finding sustainable pork and the challenges with that. But where did you can't market manure at lunchtime come from as a concept?
It refers to the opening story of the book, which is about a time when our CEO and founder, Fidel Boccio, had spent 2 years learning about what's called concentrated animal feeding operations. They're known as CAFOs. And in that process, he had met with families that lived next to intensive hog operations. He had sat in the living room and talked to parents who weren't able to let their children play outside because the stench of the manure coming from these pork farms was so strong that they have higher incidences of asthma and other lung-related illnesses in these areas. And he was pissed. So he started speaking anytime anybody asked him, and often before anybody asked him, about this experience that he had had and the horrors of what was going on in industrial agriculture. It didn't matter to him that it was actually our pork producer that had one of those farms. It mattered to them, though, that a customer was bad-mouthing them. So the head of sustainability for our pork producer, who happened to be the largest in the country, flew to our offices to say, can you stop saying bad things about us, please? And Fidel was not having it. He was going on and on about these manure lagoons and how we had to make change. And I was sitting there silently cheering him on, going, yes, we're going to make real environmental change. This is not right for people who live near these areas. This is not right for air quality. At the same time, I had my business hat on and I was thinking, you can't market manure at lunchtime. And what that meant to me was, yes, we want to make real environmental change, but we also want to get credit with our customers for it. And in order to do that, you need to be able to talk about it. And manure is pretty darn unappetizing when you're selling sandwiches. So the book, I hope, is a practical how-to guide for anybody that wants to make real environmental or social change, be it sustainability, be it DEI, be it changing your supply chain in any way that's more values-driven, whatever that means to you, no matter your industry, and be able to tell a story about it that will garner you more revenue, more customers, more profit.
And I think that's such an important point, because it's often the case that people who are, you know, very idealistic and feel very strongly about the issues that we're talking about can neglect that your customer needs to know aspect of things, or even feel, you know, greenwashing, we hear all these kinds of terms, even feel that that's being disingenuous or somehow not. But there's actually a real strong, not just business case, but change case for it. And I thought that that's such an important point you make. I wrote down a quote from the book here. The ultimate goal, I'm quoting Maisie now. The ultimate goal when creating a brand based on sustainability, or let's fill in the blank of any other kind of positive change we're trying to make, is to make meaningful change and have people recognize your effort, because that creates a virtuous circle. The perfect initiative creates a real environmental or social effect, and then it sets a high bar to which peer companies must rise if they want to stay competitive, thus multiplying your impact and landing your brand on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. So that there, it's not just fame for fame's sake or getting known because, hey, look at the good we're doing. It's that doing that drives more change. And I think that's a critical piece that often gets neglected in these conversations that you're bringing out there.
I had a really clear example of that in 2005, when we became the first company to introduce a policy committing to cage-free eggs. So eggs from chickens that aren't confined to small cages for their whole lives. And we rolled out cage-free shell eggs nationwide. And then I heard from the Humane Society of the United States that one of their contacts, who was on the client side, so I worked in corporate food service. This was a person who worked for a large corporation. I can probably say who it is at this point because the company is so old. It was AOL, who at the time was a really hot and growing company that had a lot of employees to feed. And the AOL client said to their food service provider, who wasn't Bon Appetit, we should have cage-free eggs. And the food service provider said, oh, well, we buy so many eggs, there isn't a supply available to us. And that client said, well, Bon Appetit's doing it nationwide. So I sure think you can do it right here in Sunnyvale. And that's that moment where the bar has been raised, where you prove it's possible that others have to rise. And now you're hitting above your weight, right? Now
Yes.
you're making change beyond your company.
And this principle is such a transferable leadership principle that I really hope everyone will key in on this. Seth Godin calls it the ratchet effect, and it goes by different types of names. But what you're describing is truly it's leading by example, but that creating that this can be done, and somebody has to do it first, and then once it's done, we know, oh, okay, and then we can rise to that level if people are aware, and that can be at the level of one team leader in an organization, in a company who's doing something differently and achieving results in a more human-centered way, and then proves it's possible. And then they've got the people wanting to work for their team and so on and so forth. So that's that same principle is transferable and scalable. And I love the way that you've oriented and just brought that to the forefront.
We can also flip it. We can also flip it to a little bit more of a competitive standpoint. I've already told you I'm very goal-oriented. When it comes to business, I'm also very competitive, not in my personal life, but in business. And it also creates a problem for your competitor. It also creates a landmine for your competitor. It takes them off of their game plan when you do something so great, so clearly positive, that they now have to respond to it or look like they don't care about the planet or about the animals or about the people in their supply chain. So that's a more Machiavellian way of looking at it, but
It's
another way of
Machiavellian.
thinking of
It's
leadership.
Machiavellian, but the first thing that you said is that the change has to create a real environmental social effect, that sincerely has to be there. And then we also want to leverage that to create the competitive distinction for our business, and then that will drive change, and we'll then get to the next one, which will drive further change and further distinguish our company. Absolutely. Okay, well, that's all very idealistic and well and good, and I love that as a goal and a leverage and a way to think. And through the first story that you tell about exploring what sustainable pork was going to look like and how tricky and complicated it was, again, quoting you here in the book, you get to the point of saying, okay, it doesn't seem like this should be that complicated, but it is. And so you say, even if it wasn't complicated to achieve our goal, and it wasn't a viable business. This is what you'll face, listener, when you start doing this right. You'll be learning all the time. You'll face situations that seem hopelessly complex, and you'll feel like you're losing the battles you take on. That might just mean you haven't picked the right battles. And so the foundation of this book and your work here, Maisie, and really why I was so eager to have you on the show is because you acknowledge the complexity of creating and driving change, and that it's not easy, and that these are very interwoven and can be very challenging systems to change. And so I'd love to have you unpack that for us a little bit in whatever way makes sense for you. And then we'll get into the levers and the three steps that you recommend we go through to get there. But let's start by talking about the complexity and why things can be challenging so that, we're being realistic here and not losing heart right away.
Well, I think that advocates, be they professional advocates or activist consumers, often think that making change is as simple as writing a bigger check. That if corporations were just less greedy, if they were willing to pay more, then all these good things would happen. And I can't tell you how many times I wished it was simply that easy. But these issues are opportunities for leadership exactly because they are so hard. As I've said to my team a million times, if it was easy, somebody else would have already done it. And we use a lot of the concepts around what's known to many as disruptive design, or using the saying, building the plane while you're flying it, which is trying to solve problems that you can't even anticipate at the beginning as you go along. And it doesn't mean that you don't have a plan. You should always have a theory of change. You should have a plan, but you should be willing to let go of that as you learn. And if you're not learning, you are sure to crash that plane, I promise you. In the case of the food industry, and we were talking about pork, one of the major complications is that you're dealing with a live animal, that you're dealing with an animal that grows at a certain rate, that takes a certain amount of space, that has to be harvested, which is the euphemism for slaughter, which I guess is probably a euphemism for kill, at a certain time, or else the animal continues to grow and the meat quality changes. That we're dealing with a live animal that grows the parts of a pig in a certain proportion. So you can't grow bacon. You have to grow an entire hog, which means you also have to sell tenderloin and pig's ears and hooves as well, not just pork belly. Now, in other industries, you look at something to do with conflict minerals, let's say if you're in technology, a really complicated issue, and you're probably saying to yourself, I'm sitting in Silicon Valley, I'm sitting in Austin, wherever, you know, tech hub that's full of lots of great ideas and smart coders. How am I supposed to figure out what's going on in a mine in halfway across the world, right? But somehow when you open the door to these questions about sustainability, about values, all of a sudden you have all of those complexities, not just the problem that sits in front of you today to get the project done that's on a piece of paper, but truly a global scope. And that is also the fun of it. That's where your real problem-solving skills come into play. That's where you get to go and travel and meet people and talk to people. And I urge everyone to get out of their offices or their living rooms or as their extra bedrooms, as it may be these days, and get into the field, whatever that field is for you, and talk to your suppliers, talk to their suppliers, and understand the complexities of your supply chain. That's where you're going to unlock the ideas that your competitors have not bothered to look for.
And you have a number of different ways that we can find those opportunities. The metaphor that you use is picking your battle, is that there are, in these vastly complicated, interconnected systems that we're a part of, that creating change can be challenging, and that if you're running up against something that either isn't creating the change you need or isn't leveraging that change and getting known by people in some fashion, that you're not necessarily picking the right battle. So you got to decide which issues you're going to take on. And this is where you get pretty specific. Some battles will do good for the world, but don't gain you that competitive advantage as a business. And others might make you look good, but they're not actually doing the true work that needs to be done. So you need to find the ones that do real good and help you raise your profile. And that's a both and, which I just think is so critical for this kind of work, as we said to begin with. So we're going to pick the right battles. Before we do that, let me tell everyone again who we're talking to. We're talking to Maisie Gansler. The book is You Can't Market Manure at Lunchtime and Other Lessons from the Food Industry for Creating a More Sustainable Company. So again, whether your cause and your human-centered leadership values are about sustainability, or my daughter runs a sustainable fashion design business in Guatemala. Like, there's just so many different angles of all of this. So let's talk about picking the right battle. And you break it down to three steps, Maisie. And so I'd like to spend some time, if you, let's treetop, 50,000 foot level, what are these three steps? And then we'll dive in.
Well, there's a few different places to look for battles. And one of them is to follow a personal passion. And that's where Fidel and the manure lagoons come in, right? He was personally passionate about this issue. And that's a good place to start, in that you will be fueled and you will be energized. And hopefully you are representative of your customer. If you are fueled and energized, your customer will also be fueled and energized. However, it may not be the one that always has the most market recognition, like the manure lagoons. Another place to look is to look at what advocates are asking you to do. There's a whole world of professional advocates, no matter your industry. What are their current campaigns? And I always like to ask, what's the next campaign? So you're working on X today. When you get that solved, what are you going to start asking us to do next year? Or putting it another way, What do you wish a company would do that you are even been afraid to ask yet? Trying to get at that next battle, the farther looking horizon.
And so these are ways that you're describing that we can identify ideas for new initiatives, either by following your passion, talking to advocates, listening to customers. One lens that I thought was fun as you're talking about this step of identifying ideas for new initiatives, you recommended this very creative. Go look at the people who you don't want to be like, but see what they're reacting against. And you share some examples of larger companies who are promoting, hey, our stuff is this. And you're like, ooh, well, whatever this is, it's maybe something I should be paying attention to.
Yeah, I think you should read really widely. Read the stuff from whatever your version of conservative is to whatever your version of ultra liberal is. And you probably want to be somewhere between the two, but you want to understand what the whole spectrum is talking about.
Reminds me of my high school environmental sciences teacher. He said in his selection of the textbook, he said, I looked long and hard for a textbook that had an equal volume and volume in terms of amount and volume in terms of how loud they were critics on both sides of the spectrum. And I said, this is going to be a good textbook. Yeah. So as we're choosing the about choosing the place where we want to focus our time and effort, you know, the first step is to find your focus. And you recommend thinking about whether you want to be single-minded or take on multiple issues. And there's some different trade-offs in that. Let's talk about that a little bit.
Well, some companies have a very clear vision of what the value or the problem they're trying to solve is. An example of that is Impossible Foods that has the Impossible Burger. Maybe people have seen it in their supermarket or at Burger King, of all places. And that was a company founded by a man named Pat Brown, who was a professor at Stanford, who really was focused on climate change. So he had a single focus, a single lens, which was climate change. And he decided through all of his scientific research that the single most important thing that he could do to stem climate change was to get people to eat less beef. So his solution to his very clear problem was a burger that would replace beef with plants. Now, conversely, still staying in the food world, if you look at a company like Whole Foods, which takes, no pun intended, a more holistic approach, or maybe that is pun intended, a holistic approach to sustainability. So they talk about climate change, but they also talk about animal welfare. They talk about trade relations. They talk about soil and pesticides. They talk about sustainable seafood. They have this general approach to sustainability. And you need to decide for your company, do you have one issue specifically, or do you want to be known as generally sustainable? That's the first step.
So we're going to find our focus. Are we going single-minded or more general? And then I think the other element, if for folks who are listening who are like, okay, maybe I'm not starting my own business right now, but I'm leading within an organization, is you still have that decision about, you know, what do you want to stand for? What is the change you can accomplish? And choosing a narrow enough focus that you can achieve some change, create the valid difference that you're trying to make, and create the awareness of it within your organization and then go from there. Maybe that's in a couple of things, maybe it's in one thing. So the principle still applies. And then we're going to identify those ideas for new initiatives, like you said, by looking your area of passion, talking to advocates, listening to customers, reading widely. And then there's managing your portfolio, which is an important part of this process. So you got a portfolio of ideas. And I remember you're talking to somebody, you were interviewing somebody at Clif Bar. I remember reading in the book and just the wealth of so many ideas. We call it an idea garden in our business. And so we have an idea garden, and sometimes I think it's an idea jungle, but you've got this portfolio of ideas. How do you manage all of that?
Well, at Bon Appetit, we have a kind of internal brand for our sustainability, and it's called Circle of Responsibility. And I came up with what we call the Circle of Responsibility matrix, or a core matrix. And it sounds fancy. It's the most simple Excel spreadsheet you've ever seen. And it has three sections: red, yellow, and green. Green are all of the things that we have made public commitments about. Yellow are the areas that we're actively working on, the ideas that are in progress, and red are the ideas that we haven't started on or that we're just stumped on. So as you're generating all of these ideas, you need to capture them. You're going to go to visit a factory, you're going to go to a conference you've never attended before, and hopefully you're going to be scribbling lots of notes and your mind's going to be going a million miles a minute and creating that jungle, as you said. You've got to nail that jungle down. So you've got this spreadsheet. You put things either they're red, yellow, or green. And then you pull that out on a regular basis, quarterly or maybe even weekly if you're in a very changing time. And you say, are the greens still green? The things that we've publicly committed to, are they still true? Because things change, right? Supply chains change. Are they still industry leading, or has it become table stakes? Is it what everybody's doing right now? The yellows, why have we not been able to move them to green? What do we need to do in order to make a commitment around this? Is it a supply problem? Is it an understanding of the issues problem? Is there still people within the organization that aren't on board with the idea yet? What do we have to do with those yellows? And then the reds, why are we stuck? Is it money? Is it even knowing where to start? Can we break it down into smaller pieces so we can start? Has anybody in a different industry taken on the similar issue that we could learn from? And it seems obvious that you want a big green list, those public commitments, but you actually really need big yellow and red lists. Those are the things that are fueling innovation. That's where the leadership is really happening. And so you've got to keep refilling those yellow and red lists as you move things to green.
I am curious as you describe that, how you manage resource allocation, because the bigger green list you have that you need to maintain, that also requires more and more input. And it's kind of like when you buy a house, right? You've got to plan on a certain amount of budget to maintain that. So then that has to increase as you have a bigger and bigger green list as well. How do you make choices about which reds you're going to start working on to get into yellows and so forth?
Well, you've got to always think about what you're going to get the biggest bang for your buck in terms of the most credit in the marketplace. And maybe that's the most credit with your direct customer. Maybe it's the most credit in the press to get yourself known by more customers. You define what credit looks like for you, and it's probably going to change in different life cycles of your business, different stages of life, the life cycle of your business. And then I always ran in my head what I called my own internal cap and trade system, which is it's really easy for companies to look at sustainability initiatives as always costing more money, but in some cases, they actually save money. If you look at a waste reduction strategy, for example, and the natural inclination is to say, well, if we can reduce waste and save money, that's going to go right to my bottom line. So that's good. I wouldn't say, can you do a cap and trade? Meaning, if I saved money by reducing waste, can I spend that same money on a more expensive input someplace else? So I come out even, but I have now created two sustainability initiatives for zero cost.
So it's a way of paying for one by finding another that saves. Yeah.
Exactly.
Love it.
Right.
Oh, interesting. Hadn't thought about that. I'm even in our business, I'm, thinking through some of the, as I read your book, it got my wheels turning about where do I want to do more in our, so I'll have to put some thought into that.
You mentioned your daughters in sustainable fashion. So let's take that as an example. One of the most wasteful, from a sustainability standpoint, parts of the fashion industry is the amount of fabric that's left on the cutting room floor, right? You've got this huge input into your fabrics, and then you cut out your pattern, and there might be as much left over. So maybe an initiative is to figure out how to take those scraps and turn them into another product. So now you're saving money, but you're also selling something else, right? And maybe you can take, you mentioned, I think that she was in Guatemala. Now I'm making things up, but maybe those scraps can be woven in a particular way into a new type of fabric using a local artisan. And now you're supporting a local artisan by challenging them to use the fabric differently. And now you've got a social component to your waste reduction strategy.
Oh, yes, you are speaking her language. Absolutely. Our guest today is Maisie Gansler. The book is You Can't Market Manure at Lunchtime and Other Lessons from the Food Industry for Creating a More Sustainable Company. And, you know, listener, we've been talking about some of these key steps in terms of identifying the change that you might want to make and the criteria you should look at in terms of the ability to make true change, as well as the ability for that to be known to leverage more change and to create the advantages for your team or organization. Part of the value of this book, Maisie, is that you interview so many different industry leaders, and there are a couple of these concepts that weave throughout that you highlight in different ways. I just wanted to highlight a couple of them and get your comment. But one of them was this concept of relationship capital. And it came out by that term in an interview with Ernie Farley from Good Farms. But you reference it in a lot of places, the relationships that you'll build with advocacy groups, with different folks. And it's not a quid pro quo. It's not that. It's a long-term true relationship. And again, from a leadership perspective and a sustainability and a long-term and human center, I mean, just all these things. Like, I just thought that this notion of relationship capital was so important, and wanted to get your take on what that means to you, how you think about it, how you invest in relationships, in some ways that maybe we can practice ourselves.
Well, it's really easy to think about activists, for example, as your enemies. They want you to make change. They often feel like they're attacking your organization, because they are. That's why it feels that way. And what I posit, and what I think Ernie is a great example of, is turning that relationship around and saying, how can we become allies versus enemies? And he tells the story of working with United Farm Workers. Previously, in another farm situation, he had actually been responsible for having the president of the United Farm Workers arrested multiple times from doing actions on his farms. So that's how negative this relationship was, right? Hopefully you are not in such a terrible place in your own business that you're having people arrested. But that's where Ernie was. He had a change of mindset. Now, importantly, so did the United Farm Workers, to say, we can actually both achieve more together. We actually are not on opposite sides. Where is our common ground? And he entered into an organization called the Equitable Food Initiative, which is how I actually met him. We were on the board together. And through the Equitable Food Initiative, which aimed to empower farm workers and to transform the agricultural industry to be more fair and just, and also profitable for the farmers. The Equitable Food Initiative understands that everybody needs to make money along that supply chain. He was able to form a positive relationship with those exact same people at the United Farm Workers Organization. The exact people he had arrested, he would now call my brother. And the next time that there was a major disruption in the agricultural industry, there were huge protests in Baja, Ernie actually flew with the United Farm Workers and Costco, his largest customer, to Baja to meet with the organizations that were causing the disruption and stand shoulder to shoulder. He was able to cash in on that relationship capital and to get into rooms that he would not have been able to, except for the fact that he was being vouched for by the advocacy groups, by the United Farm Workers. So a real business benefit that came from investing in that relationship. And I found again and again that those advocates are actually your best friends. They're the ones that have the deep knowledge. On my team, I don't have anybody completely dedicated to seafood or completely dedicated to poultry, yet these advocacy groups do. They have people with PhDs in this stuff who are just waiting for you to call them and ask them questions. It's really free consulting. And then when you do have an initiative that's ready to go public that makes that green list, they become your PR engine. Now it's not just you telling your story, it's professional advocates that people trust telling your story.
And that is not a I give something today, I get something tomorrow kind of a relationship. You're truly investing. And I just love the story that you shared from your conversation with Ernie and the way that you're talking about it. Again, the leadership principle for us of where is the common ground, and that sometimes the people who we might feel the most perceived hostility with because of the attacks, like you said, they are real. They're not, it's not that you're not seeing something real there, like that there's opportunity there and expertise and all the things. So just a very different way for us to posit and frame and think about those relationships and to start investing. I just thought that was so powerful.
And sometimes you've got to take a little bit of your time and give it to their issue, even if it's not your own issue. I have a over 20-year relationship with the Seafood Watch program from the Monterey Bay Aquarium. And every time they call me, the answer is yes, including they asked me to go to Bangkok to a blue swimming crab conference. I don't know anything about blue swimming crabs. I don't necessarily care about blue swimming crabs, or I thought until I got to the conference and learned a lot. And then, of course, I cared about them. But it was important to my partner. So I got on a plane and I flew to Bangkok and I met in a windowless conference room because, you know, business travel always sounds more glamorous than it is. Really, you're in a conference room by a hotel with a different temperature and some good food, hopefully. And I learned about blue swimming crabs because it was important to them. Then when I need Seafood Watch, when we're writing a new antibiotics policy around antibiotics used in farm seafood, I know that they will provide the expertise that I need at the drop of a hat because I provide the expertise they need at a drop of a hat.
So powerful. Maisie, we are getting close to time here. I've got at least one more, though, that I want to get to. But before I do that, I'd love to, again, listener, really encourage you, pick up this book, You Can't Market Manure at Lunchtime. You're going to get so much value. You're going to enjoy reading it. I think you'll be inspired, and you're going to get so much practical value, too. Maisie, where can people connect with you? Where would you direct them to learn more, find the book, and so forth?
Well, they can find me at MaisieGansler.com, which is MaisieGanzler. Or on LinkedIn, if you only get part of that correct. And the book, You Can't Market Manure at Lunchtime, is available in most independent booksellers, which is great, but also, of course, on Amazon. In an interesting time in my career, I've actually transitioned out of full-time work at Bon Appetit into a strategic advisory role, which is giving me time to spend with other companies. And I've been doing corporate retreats and workshops and things like that. So if anybody would like to really dig into this on their turf, I'd be happy to do so.
And you would get an excellent consultant, I must say, in the process there. All right. Well, you had mentioned earlier the co-founder, CEO of Bon Appetit, Fidel Baccio. And there's in your interview with him, you asked a very important question, which I know listeners, if they've made it this far, are going, what about me? Which is middle managers. If I am a middle manager, which we have many of listening to the show, and I'm a middle manager and I want to affect change in an organization, can I do that? How do I do that? Is it possible? And Fidel had a perspective. I'm curious your perspective, and that might be a good place for us to wrap up our conversation today.
Yeah. Well, Fidel's perspective was something that might seem like a radical step to some. Fidel's perspective was that as a middle manager, you're in the perfect position to leave your job, start a new company, and disrupt your industry because you know your industry backwards and forwards. You're the person closest to the front lines. You can come at it from a different perspective and truly disrupt. So that's what Fidel said. Leave your middle management job and start your own company. And I think that's great advice if you're a risk-taking person like Fidel is, for sure. I would say if you're not quite ready for that, start with figuring out what your sphere of influence is. What contracts are you responsible for that you can change without having sign off from others? What customers do you talk to directly? Who works for you and what do they care about? what can you start doing within your current role? It may not be revolutionizing your entire company's portfolio, but you have power within your current role. Then once you've got some wins, when you can show that you've made change and you have made a customer happier by doing it, or you've saved money, or you've created a new product line, then you start talking about that and infecting others, right? Inspiring your peers now, your fellow middle managers, to make change within their sphere of influence, making your supervisor look good. I worked under Fidel for 30 years, and my job was to make Fidel look good, not to make me look good, right? So getting your manager kudos because of the changes that you're making, it will catch on, because I can tell everybody it's intoxicating to do the right thing, make a change, and get market credit. It feels fantastic.
That is an inspiring note to wrap up our conversation on today, Maisie. Thank you so much for that word. And you've given us the means to do it. You've given us the steps to take to find those issues. You've given us the spreadsheet to use to track our reds to yellows to greens, and making sure we got more reds and yellows, and keeping that fresh. Finding the topics, the issues, the areas of focus that are going to do real good and help you raise your profile in the good that you're doing. And if you're in that middle management role, like you said, and make your boss look good in the process is going to help as well. Maisie Gansler, that is some powerful wisdom to help us be the leader that you'd want your boss to be. And I thank you for being a guest today on the show.
Thank you so much for giving me this platform. I really appreciate it.
It has been our pleasure. All right. Go out there and be that leader, and we'll see you next time.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.